Welcome to the Totem Figures Podcast. I'm TJ Dawe. Mark Meer is an Edmonton-based actor, writer, and improviser. His Mount Rushmore would feature Jim Henson, John Cleese, Alan Moore, and Tom Waits with an extra spot for Dr. Doom. We started off talking about Jim Henson. So tell me about Jim Henson.
Jim Henson essentially introduced me to sketch comedy. All the Muppet sketches on Sesame Street and then the Muppet Show itself. That's what really introduced me to old-timey style comedy. You know, the fact that sometimes the jokes were especially corny, I think even helped because those Muppets knew how to sell a gag.
I'll be darned. You say that's your boy? How could you have a son that age?
I didn't. When I had him, he was just a baby.
That man is annoying me.
He isn't even looking at you.
That's what's annoying me.
I can't understand it. I just can't seem to hold on to a job. My last one only lasted for 10 minutes.
Yeah, what were you doing?
I was a librarian.
And that's not generally how that show is thought of.
No, it's thought of as a kids show, but it was a variety show.
Yeah,
and just as Carol Burnett was sort of fading away, and those types of shows
with a nominal backstage story of them trying to put on the show.
Yes, and which also, SCTV was also an early influence on me.
And were there any times where on SCTV or on the Muppet Show you didn't get the jokes, but you wanted to watch it anyway?
Oh, certainly, yeah. I mean, and things where you were being introduced to references that you didn't quite understand, and as far as you knew, they originated on that show. But then slowly you'd begin to discover that, no, this is actually referencing an obscure star from the 1930s. Jim Henson, in particular, influenced me because not only was he generating all this content, but he was also a real person that I could potentially meet one day. I always wanted to meet Jim Henson. His death actually really affected me on an emotional level. It's one of the few celebrity deaths that actually really hit home for me. Mostly because, and selfishly, I went, I'll never get to meet Jim Henson. I'll never get to shake his hand and tell him how much he influenced my sense of humor, my appreciation of the same things he liked.
You didn't go into puppeteering, for instance. You don't
create
creatures.
Right over there is a room full of puppets.
Right, you do have a house full of...
I do.
Of objects and monsters.
And occasionally, I'm a dabbler in terms of puppetry. I know many friends. I have many friends that are professional puppeteers and excellent ones.
But what aspect of his stuff that really hit home with you, that really became part of what you do professionally?
Puppets are like masks. They enable you to just immediately jump into a character. Like mask work, it allows you to express things that you wouldn't normally, even when you're playing a character. The fact that you're able to essentially inhabit this other body, operating puppet, you're putting yourself into that piece of felt with ping pong balls glued onto it, and it becomes another person. When people interact with puppets, they generally won't look at the puppeteer, they will look at the puppet. They'll address their comments to the puppet, that sort
Absolutely.
Of thing. And I guess it's that sort of transformative quality that always impressed me. And I was really struck when I was a kid, when I found out that Kermit and Ernie were the same person. They're the same guy, and all these characters that he plays, and that really impressed me. That he's all these characters, or Mel Blanc, for example. Do you mean Bugs Bunny is Barney Rubble?
Right. So, did you aspire to be able to be that kind of a chameleon yourself?
I think so. Yeah, I do tend to like disguise myself in costumes and roles and.
Which isn't something every actor does, even improv actors.
No, it's true.
A lot of people just play themselves, a variation of themselves, which can be brilliant.
Yes, yeah, most certainly. And I've certainly worked with people who do that fantastically. But I do tend to be the kind of actor or improviser who likes to disappear into his character.
So what aspects of your humor have been opened up by the freedom to play extreme characters like that?
Well, the clowning also relates to this. Once you find a character that doesn't censor itself, you're sort of there with them, but the character, to a certain extent, is saying what they want to say. Especially when you're dealing with improv, which is, to a large extent, stream of consciousness. You're not censoring yourself, or you're not supposed to. I played characters that I'm surprised by what I find myself saying. And also realized, I really couldn't have got away with that, but this character can.
Are there any specific Jim Henson puppets or Muppets in general that stand out to you as someone who just perfectly does that? But that always inspired you with how far they would go?
You can always look to the example of Miss Piggy. I think Miss Piggy is probably fairly far from Frank Oz's actual personality. Ernie, I'd say, would be Jim Henson's, you know, go far, do anything. Kermit was always, like, a fairly reasonable sort, and especially on The Muppet Show, he was, you know, when he was in charge, he
trying to keep things in control,
the facilitator, and things like that. But Ernie was, I'd say, Jim Henson's clown character, because, you know, he could always, you know, hey, Bert, you know, push Bert's buttons, right, push him as far as possible. And even though, in large measure, Ernie's usually being a jerk to Bert, Bert just wants to collect his bottle caps and look at his pigeons, but but Bert never has your sympathy, you know.
It's true.
Ernie generally has your sympathy, even though he's usually just being a jerk to Bert, or at least irritating to him.
Hi, Ernie.
Oh, hey there, Bert.
I see you going outside, huh?
Oh, yes, that's right, Bert.
Yeah, you're all dressed up for the cold.
Yes, indeed I am, and I'm also dressed up for something else, Bert. Oh. I'm all dressed up for a guessing game that I just made up, Bert. Would you like to play a guessing game with me?
No.
Okay, here's how it goes, Bert. You have to guess, what do I have inside my mittens, Bert? Inside my mittens.
Inside your mittens?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to play this game.
Now think about it, Bert. Think about it. Think hard. What's inside my mittens?
Your hands. Your hands are inside your mittens. Okay, Ernie?
My hands. Well, let's just see if you're right. Ooh, look at that, Bert. You're right. It is my hands that are inside my mittens, Bert. Very good. You got the first one right, Bert. Now, second one is, what is inside my sleeve, Bert?
I don't want to play this game.
What's inside my sleeve? Think hard, Bert.
It's too easy, Ernie.
This is not an easy one, Bert.
Your arm. Your arm.
My arm.
Yes.
You say my arm.
Tell me about John Cleese.
Now, John Cleese, I talked about how Jim Henson, you know, was my intro to sketch comedy. John Cleese and Monty Python as a whole, that's what blew the doors off. SCTV, certainly, but I was introduced to Monty Python first, and first through audio tapes. So I didn't actually know what anyone looked like.
How old would you have been when you were listening to these tapes?
Like, quite young, actually, like probably around like 10 or 11.
Huh. And how much of it did you get?
Mostly, well, you know, like slowly I started to, you know, get more and more of it. My mother's from Ireland and we'd go back there quite often. So I did have a broader base of knowledge for UK-based humor than, say, most North American kids, because we'd go to England and Ireland in the summers. And actually, I should mention that John Cleese was one of the few pictures I'd seen, and it, you know, that famous Ministry of Silly Walks picture. In the early stages of things, as far as I knew, he was Monty Python. And in fact, I did think that that guy's name was Monty Python.
And that he did all the voices?
And had the impression that, yeah, he was sort of a Mel Blanc type that was doing all the voices in all these sketches, rather than being five guys doing a million different voices. But John Cleese, he goes on my Rushmore as a figurehead for the entire Python group, and to an extent, sketch comedy as a whole.
What do you think John Cleese's strengths as a comic actor are?
He embodies a style of comedy, and his style of comedy would be the more controlling aspect of comedy, the different types of clowns, the red nose, white face. Going back to Jim Henson, Bert and Ernie. Ernie's the red nose, Bert is the white face. The red nose wants the audience to love him, the white face wants the audience wants to control the audience. John Cleese, I would say, falls very much into the realm of the white face clown, where he is essentially in control of the situation. And perhaps his character will lose control of the situation, but as an actor, as a performer, he's calculating.
Stop! Leaving, Cleese! Leaving. Where's all the others then?
Not here.
I can see that. What's the matter with them?
I don't know. Perhaps they've got flu.
Flu? Flu? Maybe eating too much fresh fruit. Right, now, self-defense. Tonight, I should be carrying on from where I got to last week. When I was showing you how to defend yourself against anyone who attacks you armed with a piece of fresh fruit.
You promised you wouldn't do fruit this week.
What do you mean?
Well, we've done fresh fruit for the last 9 weeks.
What's wrong with fruit? You think you know it all, eh?
Well, can't we do something else for a change?
Like someone who attacks you with a pointed stick.
Pointed sticks? Oh, we want to learn how to defend ourselves against pointed sticks, do we? Getting all iron mighty, eh? Fresh fruit not good enough for you, eh? Oh. Well, I'll tell you something, my lad. When you're walking home tonight and some homicidal maniac comes after you with a bunch of loganberries, don't come trying to leave.
And are you the red nose or are you the white face when you're on stage?
I think I tend towards white face. But at the same time, I crave the adulation of the audience, so I don't know. I'm a white nose. And you can be both. You can be, yeah.
Which Monty Python sketch would you say showcases John Cleese at his best? Or is there one that you think should be better known than it is? Because there are ones like the Ministry of Silly Walks or the Dead Parrot that are so associated with Monty Python.
Yes.
But there's a lot of stuff that was on the TV show that never made the albums, or that just the public never references.
And actually, you know, in terms of the movies, I'd say, you know, Holy Grail and Life of Brian tend to get the most attention, but actually Meaning of Life is probably my favorite of the Monty Python movies.
And what is it about that?
The structure of the movie itself, with one sketch bleeding into the other. And what I do now, when we do improv heralds and things like that, our structure is quite similar. And ideally, you do like to have things link back to the beginning, so that the piece as a whole has a sort of circular structure.
Even though there isn't a plot.
Even though there isn't a plot.
Right.
Yeah, it's more of a thematic structure rather than a plot structure.
Which is definitely the meaning of life.
Yes, most definitely.
Was there a point where your love of comedy kind of broke open? Because I remember in my own life, I was very limited in my references up to a certain point, and then it just occurred to me that there's so much out there, and I suddenly wanted to have it all.
Yeah, I would say it would probably be in junior high for me, is when the doors really flew open, because I'd always liked Monty Python and SCTV, of course, but I'd never seen Saturday Night Live, for example, and never listened to, like, a stand-ups recordings. And that's when I really got into comedy in general. But again, like, I had no idea that I was going to be a performer. As far as I knew, this was just, you know, something I liked. I was intending to enroll in science in university. I didn't even take drama in high school because it wasn't an option. We didn't have it. I had to take art by correspondence. I lived in a small town, and it wasn't until I moved to Edmonton that I realized one could theoretically perform for a living.
And do you remember that moment?
I think it was when I first got into improvisation, and that was a direct result of auditioning for a show. It was at the Teen Festival of the Arts here at the Citadel Theater. Used to run that, and a troupe called Three Dead Trolls in a Baggie. They basically cast a show with teenagers, and the teenagers wrote and performed in the show. They directed, and they suggested improv as a tool for writing sketches.
Which you'd never done before.
I'd never done before, no. I didn't really even know that everyone else that was here, of course, they'd all been doing it for the last 3 years in drama class. I had no idea that that existed. I'd never heard of Keith Johnstone. I'd never heard of theater sports.
And did you take to it readily?
I did, yeah. Immediately, it just seemed like, well, this is what I've been missing. I've been waiting for this all my life. Especially when I realized it's like, oh, this is what people from Second City did. You know, I wasn't even aware of the improv component behind Second City or Saturday Night Live or any of these troupes.
Right. Much less that it's the foundation for everything. Exactly.
You
do.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about Alan Moore.
Well, Alan Moore. Alan Moore first reared his head in my life when he took over a comic called Swamp Thing. I was an avid comic reader, and still am. Swamp Thing, up to that point, had just been sort of a straightforward horror comic. Its protagonist was a scientist who'd been caught in an explosion and turned into some sort of plant monster. And when Alan Moore came on board, he turned everything on its head. Up till this point, everything in Swamp Thing's adventures had generally revolved around him attempting to find a cure and get turned back into a human so he could live a normal life. What Alan Moore did is, the first thing he did was shoot Swamp Thing in the head. He had one of his enemies capture him, shoot him in the head, kill him, dead. And then perform an autopsy on him. And in the course of this autopsy, you find out that Swamp Thing was never human. He's completely plant matter, and he is essentially a plant that somehow, through the accident, absorbed the memories of Alec Holland. But he was never Alec Holland, and so there's no way he will ever be human again. He thinks he has its memories, but he's just a plant. And so that just completely changed the dynamic of the character utterly. And the fact that Alan Moore is such a great writer and was able to take it in all these different directions, where suddenly he essentially threw out the entire premise of the character and started fresh.
And yet it was the same character.
And yet it was the same character. It was sort of like, well, you've always been this. It was a retroactive continuity change. But
yeah, so he didn't disrupt the continuity.
He didn't, yeah. It's like everything that's happened has happened, but you were just mistaken up to this point. And that, of course, opened the doorways for, you know, all the sort of weird metaphysical directions that he took Swamp Thing in, where the Swamp Thing eventually ended up being a plant elemental. And one in a long series of plants. There's always been this sort of earth spirit protector of the planet, and he's the latest incarnation of that. And they always take the memories of a dead man so that, you know, they're able to interact with humans and things like that. And he turned it into a story about heaven and hell, introducing concepts, just metaphysical and spiritual concepts in a comic book form. So, I mean, that was my introduction to Alan Moore, was through Swamp Thing. And then he took it many steps further with V for Vendetta, with Miracle Man and then Watchmen, which today is still one of my favorite comics. I go back every few years and reread Watchmen in its entirety, and I still, to this day, I'll pick up on something new. And there's certain chapters of the book that are structured to be symmetrical. They're, you know, the structure is identical forwards and backwards. Like, you get to a certain middle point, and then it's, you know, it's, his mind is fascinating to me.
So if someone were to say that comics are for kids, they're garbage, they're pulp, there's nothing of value in comics, would you recommend they read Alan Moore?
I certainly would.
Where would be a good place to start?
Well, The Watchmen is always the one that I recommend because it's a self-contained story, and it is so literate, so dense, that I can't imagine anyone being able to level those same complaints after reading it.
What has Alan Moore's effect on you been as an artist?
I like to think he's made me more thoughtful. He's made me realize that you can challenge your audience constantly, because much of the time when I was reading Alan Moore, I was struggling to keep up. I had to do research to be able to understand the concepts that he was putting forward.
Well, people might level some of the same complaints at improv or sketch, is that it's just silliness. There's really, you know, it's just light entertainment.
Yes. Yeah, it can be, certainly.
It can be, but it also can have the potential to introduce more intelligent elements.
Oh, yes.
To challenge the audience, to raise the bar. Mm-hmm. Would you say there's a parallel between what he was doing as a comic book writer and what you try to do as a stage performer?
Yeah, I'd say, and, you know, you look at the comic industry and you look at improvisation as an art form as well, and you could draw parallels there, because generally when people start improv, they start to improvise, they're going to be doing short form, and it's going to be comedic. Almost every improviser I know who's been at it for any length of time will start to gravitate towards long form comedy, where you're not just making jokes, you're telling a story.
And why do they do that?
I think it just becomes more interesting for the performer, because it's much more satisfying to step back, look at the show that you've just done, and realize that you created a cohesive narrative with themes that played throughout the story. And maybe you weren't even aware that you were doing that at the time. But ultimately, I think that is more satisfying than doing an alphabet game and then a moving bodies game. And then, you know, that ultimately, that's not to say that there's no place for that. And I certainly enjoy doing short form. And you like to mix things up, obviously. And you use different muscles when you improvise in different styles. But, I'd say that most improvisers will tend to gravitate towards long-form comedy just because it's more satisfying to them as performers. And ultimately, I think it does, especially if you've got an audience who's watching you over, you know, a long period, and the people who come back every week, I think it's more satisfying for them as well.
Okay. Just like comic book readers.
Just like comic book readers.
Tell me about Dr. Doom.
Well, Dr. Doom, he is probably my favorite comic book character. I've always enjoyed the villains. And many people say the same thing. Like, the Joker is more psychologically interesting than Batman. You know, in the last Dark Knight movie, who was the more engaging character? I think we are fascinated by darkness and by the evil. Dr. Doom particularly interests me because he's a character who wears his flaws on his sleeve. he's a complete megalomaniac. Utterly arrogant. He's a guy who fights, you know, these massively powerful quartet of heroes. In fact, usually takes on all the heroes at once. But he doesn't have any powers himself. Like Iron Man, he's a guy who built this suit out of his own ingenuity, and beyond that has, you know, mastered time travel and sorcery. And so extremely powerful, but everything that he's done, he's learned himself.
Right, so everything comes out of his own will and
intelligence. Out of his own unbreakable, unshakable will and faith in himself.
And can you imagine somebody saying that about you?
No. Perhaps that's what I aspire to.
You mean in the best possible world.
I guess so. But yeah, that's the thing about Dr. Doom, is that ultimately he wants to rule the world because he's pretty sure he's the best person for the job. And his motivations are, in, you know, to free the soul of his mother from the netherworld. His mother's in hell. And to rule the world, because he's the best man for the job. And sort of his one sort of real flaw is his just unreasoning hatred and jealousy for Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four, who is the one man who is smarter than him, and that he cannot abide.
Right. And do you have a Reed Richards in your life?
I'm a softie. I'm not Dr. Doom. I like Dr. Doom.
So you're more of a healthier Dr. Doom.
I guess so. If there's a Reed Richards in my life, I'd probably just admire them. I encounter people that are smarter and funnier than me all the time, and I tend to look up to them.
And you don't try and take them
down? I don't try to take them.
Okay.
But I enjoy. I don't seek to emulate Doctor Doom. I should make that clear. But I really enjoy a bombastic supervillain.
All right. Yeah. Tell me about, speaking of bombastic, mm-hmm. Tell me about Tom Waits.
Ah, Tom Waits. Tom Waits. Now he's easily my favorite musician of all time. Favorite songwriter. Favorite musician. If you've ever listened to some of his early recordings, he had quite a good voice, melodic
absolutely,
voice
yeah.
in the day.
Blue skies over my head, give me another reason to get out of bed. Blue skies shining my face, give me another woman to take her place.
But it was as he became more, you know, raspy and guttural, I think that his songwriting really starts to come to the fore, that you really notice the lyrics. And I love his wordplay. I love the pictures he creates. I love the narratives in his songs. And he can say so much with, like, a simple lyric that summarizes not only the narrative but also the emotional state of everyone involved. You know, you just find yourself there in the middle of whatever he's creating.
And a million in a drop dead suit, touch your ping on a downtown train, $2 pistol but the gun won't shoot. I'm in the corner on the pouring rain, 16 men on a dead man's chest, and I've been drinking.
Which period of his songwriting really appeals to you? Because he was very different from one set
to another. It's true. I have to say, I've really enjoyed his sort of latest incarnation as a musical theater writer. Like the Black Rider is fantastic, and I've had the good fortune to see it performed here. Friends of mine did the North American premiere, and I think I've seen that production. It's been remounted a few times, but I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times. I haven't been fortunate enough to see Blood Money or Alice, but Black Rider is fantastic. I only have the supports, but I've never seen them performed live.
Come on along with the Black Rider. We'll have a gale time. Lay down in the web of the Black Spider. I'll drink your blood like wine. So come on in, it ain't no sin. Take off your skin and dance around in your bones. So come on along with the Black Rider. We'll have a gay old time. Right. Hold on now.
He is a supreme showman. I think that's one of the
He is. Never had the opportunity to see him live in concert. I hear it's a pretty transformative experience. And
right.
So that's something I must do before I die, or he does.
What would you say the people on your list have in common?
Well, they're all men. I didn't pick any women. Didn't pick any women, not a one. Oh, well. Sorry, Mom. Well, I would say that all of them share a sense of humor. And they each have their own particular sense of humor, but they are people who make the jokes that make me laugh.
But they all also have a very strong individual voice, each of them.
Yes, certainly. Certainly in the terms of Alan Moore and Tom Waits, they're iconoclasts. And Jim Henson as well. Like he's responsible, even though he was working collaboratively with a huge team and on whatever project he was working on, it was quite clearly he put his stamp on it.
Right.
And I would have to say, John Cleese did sort of come to the forefront. When you think Monty Python, you do think John Cleese. Again, he works more collaboratively, I think, than the others would tend to. Henson, as I say, did work collaboratively. But there's something about John Cleese that does make him stand out for the pack.
And would you say the same thing about yourself? I mean, you do a lot of collaborative work.
Mm-hmm. I do, and I prefer it. I like to work with a group. I like to see what other people are bringing to the table and what they have to say. and to build on their ideas.
And do you find
you steal their ideas for myself, really?
And do you find you have an ability to bring out what's good in other people, and vice versa?
I like to think so. I like to think so. I mean, that's collaboration. That is the point of collaboration, ideally.
Right.
Is that everybody's stronger as a group than they are as individuals. So.
Well, I think that's something else that everybody on your list has in common. They're all collaborators. I mean, Tom Waits co-writes his songs with his wife.
True, yes.
Alan Moore is always working with an illustrator.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, Black Rider, one of my favorites, he wrote that with Burroughs and Wilson.
So there's strong individual voices who know how to work as part of a team.
Yes, and I would say that's what I aspire to.